Okay. Good morning. People in the middle of the row arrived last. It's usual. Okay, good morning. Second class for this course. And unlike last week, we're now going to really do interesting stuff. Today we're going to talk about cryptology. And I will start with a general introduction into the topic, and I will say something about classical crypto systems. And then at the end, here's a total overview of what we do in crypto. So this will be the topic of today. I will start a bit with symmetric crypto also, because it's a lot of ground to cover for the 3 weeks that we have for this topic. So a bit of symmetric crypto also today. Then next week I will go... I will complete the part on stream ciphers and block ciphers and hash functions most likely, and then the third week it will be asymmetric crypto. We'll cover all these topics. So, but we'll first start with a general introduction into the topic. When I talk about cryptology, I actually are talking about two different aspects: cryptography and cryptanalysis. So what's the difference? Cryptography is, as it states here, a method of storing and transmitting data in a particular form so that only those for whom it is intended can read and process it. It's a bit of a narrow description, but it serves anyway. Cryptography is dealing apparently with protecting information, with designing systems such that I can keep information confidential. Cryptanalysis, on the other side, refers to the studies of ciphers, ciphertext, and cryptosystems with a view to finding weaknesses in them that will permit retrieval of the plaintext from the ciphertext without necessarily knowing the key or the algorithm. So while here we are protecting information with designing systems, here we are trying to break them. Yeah, so cryptology is more or less the overall field, designing good cryptosystems, making sure that we can protect our information, but also the other side trying to break these kinds of systems. So here is some ciphertext. Anybody knows what this means? I'll give you a hint, because this is slide number 5, we're still at the beginning. I'll give you a hint. Wingdings. Not sure if that was useful. Sorry? Somebody? I don't know. That's a letter type in Word, or at least in Word. Yeah. Actually, it says "not so secret," and then I just selected a text and turned it into Wingdings format, and then you get something like this. And you see that the O here and the O there apparently is the same, and the T here at the end and there at the end, that's the same symbol too. And the E you can also check, and the S apparently. So you can trust that I did it in the correct way. Obviously, this is not a good system. People will break that very quickly. But it's not said that this has never been used in the past. In the Second World War, actually the American army used Navajo Indians as code talkers. Navajo Indians spoke a kind of language that was unlike any other language in the world. And there was just a very limited group of Indians that actually spoke that language. And so if we know one particular language and we start speaking in that language, nobody can understand. So that was the idea. And so they had an alphabet which they had words assigned to, and then the Navajo words. But obviously there are some difficulties. For example, fighter plane, you can't read it here. Fighter plane is a word that really didn't exist in Navajo Indian language. They had no idea what that was. But they just took the American word hummingbird, for which there was a translation into their language, and they used that. So when they were saying, in English then, hummingbird, then the other side knew that it was about fighter planes. Yeah, just check out these two. There is a description on this, and I took that picture from this link. If you want to see a YouTube video on this, there is a link too. Last week, we talked about the CIA triad. Everybody still remember what that was about? Confidentiality, integrity, and availability. Here we slightly change it. Confidentiality, only sender and intended receiver should be able to read the message. Yeah, we talked about that. Then integrity, I should be able to detect if a message was all or not, incidentally, changed in transmission. And then instead of availability, we'll actually talk about authentication in this case. Yeah, so I took the freedom to change this. And authentication means that sender and receiver should be able to know the identity of the person on the other side. So let's go to some terminology. When I talk about plain text or message, often also used, that is information in some kind of understandable information. This you can read, maybe you don't understand, but you can read it, it's English. Yeah, that's plain text. Ciphertext, on the other hand, that's actually information that appears unintelligible. Yeah, so that's the information that I apparently can show to everybody because there is no information in there. Then algorithm. Algorithm is actually either encryption or decryption, so a fixed method to do these two operations. In encryption, I actually start with a plain text and I transform that into a ciphertext, and decryption is the other way around. But the plain text or the ciphertext are not the only input to these algorithms. It's also a key. And a key is some kind of secret information that is used in the algorithm, in the encryption or decryption algorithm. So graphically, it looks like this. I have hello world. Everybody understands hello world, intelligible information. I have an encryption algorithm that takes that plain text and some key and turns that then into a ciphertext, which nobody can make sense of. Then the decryption algorithm takes the key again and the ciphertext and turns that back into the correct plain text again. That's all. Nothing more, nothing less. That's encryption. That's cryptology. But there's some more. Who knows the two most famous people in crypto? Alice and Bob, correct. Alice and Bob. In crypto, we're talking about communication between two people that we want, for example, to keep confidential. And there is Alice. And Alice is no longer in Wonderland. She's in Cryptoland now. Alice wants to send a message to Bob. Have you noticed also that in crypto, always Alice is the one talking? We'll see that is actually not true later on. Bob is always silent, not in my slides, and I think in a week or two he also gets the opportunity to say something. So we have Alice and Bob, but there are more people in crypto. There's Eve. Eve for evil or eavesdrop or whatever you want. Eve is a woman also, and she's very curious. Like many women, Eve is very curious, and she wants to know what Alice is saying to Bob. Right? Sometimes we need more people in some kind of protocol, so then we also introduce Carol, or maybe even Dave if we need him. Dave is a bit unsure of what he's doing here, by the looks. So how does crypto work? We have Alice, and we have Bob, as I said, and often in crypto you'll see that they don't know each other, still they want to share secrets, which is odd at least. But Alice wants to say something to Bob, while Eve then turns up and wants to listen into this communication. But if everything goes well, if crypto works as it should work, then at the very end, Bob should be able to say, I know what Alice was telling me, while Eve is still unsure. In a nutshell, that was crypto. Yeah, the basic concepts, the ideas behind it. Obviously, nothing practical, so we can't do anything yet. So let's have a quick look at what has been done in the past. And in the past, that is not just the previous century, that goes back many, many centuries. Here is a list of things I will go over. I'll not show the list for that long. I'll start with Leonardo da Vinci. That is not really crypto. But can you read what he wrote? Except that it looks like a doctor's writing that you can't read. So what did he do? Yeah, exactly. If I have a mirror and I look at this text in the mirror, I can see it in plain text. So Leonardo da Vinci, in order to keep his ideas secret, his sketches secret, he just mirrored the text. Not really very safe, but anyway, that's the way he did it. Not really considered as everyday crypto. Then this, the Voynich manuscript. What this actually is, nobody knows. But there is a manuscript, and you can look through the full manuscript via that link. And in that manuscript, you see very nice detailed pictures. A lot of, now it's people, but you see also a lot of flowers and other things. And there is text underneath it. And at least from the looks of it, this looks like some meaningful text. Well, it's ciphertext because we can't read it, but it looks like it has a meaning. There are words in there. There are recurring symbols, which apparently stand for letters or something. Unfortunately, up to today, nobody has been able to understand what this is about. Maybe it's a hoax. Maybe somebody did this just for fun. Although it's very elaborate what he wrote. Then before we actually get to the real crypto system, the first one that I want to talk about, the Caesar cipher, some notation. We talked about encryption and decryption algorithms or functions before. I will use it in this manner. I have a message M, and I'm encrypting it with this encryption algorithm, and I have as input also some key K, and then out comes a ciphertext, and decryption is just the other way around. I have a ciphertext as input to a decryption algorithm with a parameter K again, and out gets the message again, if everything goes well. Sometimes I use this notation if PowerPoint doesn't allow me to use too many subscripts. All means the same. Then modulo calculations. Who doesn't know what modulo calculation is? Okay, there are a few. Okay, modulo calculation means that actually I'm not considering a full number, but I'm just reducing it. For example, if I say 3 hours from now, I'm not sure what the time is now, 3 hours from now it will be 1:30, right? It's now 11:30. What if I would ask you what is the time 25 hours from now? Now it's 10:30, you're not going to do 11:30, 12:30, yeah? You first of all, you remove a full day, because today I'm just asking about the clock time. So you remove already 24 hours. So you remove that number. You remove from that number 25. You remove 24 hours because that constitutes a day. And exactly 24 hours from now, it's the same time as it is now. Yeah? So now I reduced that 25 modulo 24. I could have asked 50 hours from now, and I reduced 50 modulo 24. And actually that means in clock time, it's 2 hours later than now. So a number modulo some value means that the result is between zero and that number m, that modulus m, and actually that the difference is a multiple of m. That sounds a bit difficult. Here's an example. I have a value, 954, and I'm calculating that modulo 73, and that will be 5. Why? 5 is in the good range. And the difference between 954 and 5 is actually a multiple of 73. So how did I figure that out? Not just guessing. No, I calculated, I divided them, and the result is slightly over 13. So that means that 73 will fit 13 times in 954, but not 14 times. So if I reduce those times that it completely fits in there, I'm left with the remainder, which is the result of the modulus. And the good thing is, with modulo, I can do any calculations. I can add, multiply, subtract, like I would normally do, and then I can reduce the end result again. So if I have two results, I add them, and then I'll take the modulus again at the end. So here's the same question again. To answer this, we actually have to apply twice modulo calculation. So as a small test, it's now 1 o'clock. It's not, but assume it's 1 o'clock. Exactly 1,000 hours from now, what is the time then? The time, not the date, the time. So who can tell me? So now would be the time to take pen and paper.
1,000 minutes or hours?
1,000, what is that right? 1,000 minutes. 1,000 minutes from now. You have to apply modulo calculation actually 2 times this. Just raise your hand if you have the answer. Don't spoil it for everybody else. Okay, there's one who has it already. Yeah, two. One more? Yeah, a few more. Okay, let's go and see what we have to do here. I said you have to apply modular calculation twice. First, I take 1,000 minutes and I express it in the number of hours and minutes. Yeah? So if I divide 1,000 by 60, the number of minutes in an hour, I get 16. So apparently I have 16 full hours in that 1,000 minutes. And then 1,000 modulo 60 is 40. So 1,000 minutes is the same as 16 hours plus 40 minutes. So now it was 1 o'clock, remember that. And 16 hours from now, forget the 40 minutes for the moment, 16 hours from now, it will be, well, not 29 something, I don't understand that. But I have to reduce that modulo 24, because I have 24 hours in a day. Second time that I'm using modulo calculation here. So that will be 5. It's 5 in the morning that represents. So 16 hours from now, it's 5 in the morning, and then I still had these 40 minutes left. So 16 hours from now, 100 minutes from 1 o'clock in the afternoon is actually 5:40 in the morning. This is not higher mathematics, so this is something relatively simple. And probably, even though you might not have known this concept before, I guess this is easy to pick up. So why did we talk about that? Well, in Caesar cipher, we're actually using modulo calculation. In a Caesar cipher, what we're doing is we are encrypting a message one letter at a time. So I can say I'm just encrypting a single letter. I have a message, which is a single letter. I have a ciphertext, which will also be then a single letter. And I have a key, which will be a single letter. But modulo calculation, we just saw that was numbers, right? And we can do calculation with numbers. It's hard to do calculation with letters, at least for me. So what we do is we'll assign numbers to them. A is represented by 0, B is represented by 1, etc., all the way up to Z being represented by 25. And now I can do calculations with numbers also. The way that I do encryption is by taking the message and adding the key. But I have to do this modulo 26 because I just have the numbers 0 up to 25. So that's why I'm doing modulo 26. 26 is then reduced to 0 again. And if encryption is adding the key, then decryption will be subtracting the key. Why is that? Because we want to end up with this property. If I have a message and somebody encrypts it and sends it to me, and then it is decrypted again, I want the same message to come out. So does that hold? Well, you can go over this. This is very simple. Obviously, if I have a number and I add something and then I subtract something, then I end up with the same number again. The fact that I'm doing modulo in between doesn't really matter because modulo spreads out over that. That was a question.
Is it the set of all the characters equivalent to the number? Or is it an additional thing that we add to the message?
No, you don't add anything to the message. The key, sorry, the question was if the key was something separate or if the key is apparently a part of the message, right? The key, the message is what I come up with. The key is what we apparently agreed upon because I need it for encryption and you need it for decryption, yeah? But the ciphertext, that's the thing that I will send to you. And the ciphertext is only the ciphertext. There is nothing else included. So it's just a single encrypted letter, right? And so everybody sees that letter coming around. Yeah, I can just shout it out. I'll say D, the ciphertext is D, and then you know how to...
But do we send the keys with the message or separately?
No. Keys are not sent with messages. Yeah?
Okay,
keys are not sent. Messages are not sent. Ciphertexts are sent. Yeah? So we only, but we have to, we'll talk about key distribution later on. Somehow, you and I need to have the same key. So there is a problem of making sure that we have that, but we don't send it together with the message, or with the ciphertext, sorry. But we'll do that beforehand. Yeah. Yeah. So as an example, let's see if we are encrypting the word hello. And well, hello is not a letter, but we'll just split this message up in 5 different letters and we'll encrypt each of them. So what happens to the first letter? Well, the key was D, which is represented by 3. The letter, or the message in this case, is H, which is represented by 7. Encryption was adding those two, modulo 26, but that's modulo is not important here. So they add up to 10, and 10 is representing the letter K. So encrypting with key value D, the message H will result in the ciphertext K. Similar, if with the key D, I encrypt the message E, well then D is represented by 3 and E by 4, so they add up to 7. 7 is representing the letter H, so the ciphertext in that case will be H. Same for the other two. When I'm encrypting the L, if I'm encrypting this L or that L, that's the same, of course. So I just wrote it down once. And if I'm encrypting the O, I'll get an R. So, in fact, if I'm encrypting with the key D, the word hello, the output will be K-H-O-O-R. Is that clear?
Okay.
Clear? Okay, good. Let's do it in an easier way. But then I need a big table. So in this big table, I already calculated what A plus B is. Yeah, that will be B. Because A is represented by 0, B is represented by 1. 0 plus 1 is 1, which stands for B. So how do I do it then? I first want to encrypt the letter H with the key D. So I look at these are the keys. These are the messages. I look at the key D, and then the message, was it H? And then if I look at the intersection of those, I will find the letter K. Same if I try to encrypt with a key D, which I always use this row because I'm using as key the letter D. Yeah, if I'm encrypting the letter, the message E, okay, I look at the top row, where the column for E is, and I go down to the correct row, and I'll find H. Yeah, and the other three also. Very easy. So encryption can simply be done by looking up the key value, looking up the message value, and looking at the intersection of those two, and I'll find the ciphertext bit. Decryption will be slightly different. In decryption, I look in the row for my good key, for the key D in this case, and I look up the value K. I'm starting looking, D-E-F-G-H-I-J-K, okay, there we are. And I look at what column I am in, and that's the column H. Yeah? So slightly different, you can do the exercise yourself. And I get back the word hello, obviously. We knew that. Yeah? So if I have a big table like this available, then I can do encryption and decryption easily by hand. Or I'll go back to the calculation that I did before. So that's a nice crypto system. This is the first crypto system that you learned about. Maybe as kids you use it. Anybody? Nobody? So obviously we're talking about confidentiality, integrity, everything here. So my first question is this a good crypto system? Is the system secure? No, yeah. That was rather obvious. Why is it not secure? Oh, way too complicated. Yeah. So the answer I have to repeat for online. The answer was about frequency of letters, which is a good answer, by the way. Yeah. But I don't care about frequency of letters. There are just 25 different keys. Well, actually, there are 26 different keys. But if I use the key value A represents 0. I add 0 or subtract 0. Yeah, that's doing nothing. Yeah. So here I have a text. And in your case, if you want to look at letter frequencies, you have to do a lot of work to go and test whatever, how often the letters A, B, C, or whatever occur here. I don't want to do that. I'm lazy. So what I do is I look at the first word. The first word in the ciphertext, which is LQIRUPDWLRQ. Any idea what that means? No. Neither do I. But what I did then is starting to shift all these letters. First, I will shift all the letters one position. I have a table. I hope you can read it. Yeah. So the word is at the top, and I shifted all these letters one position. So L becomes the next letter in the alphabet, becomes M, Q becomes R, I becomes J, etc. That result is not an English word. Okay, let's do that again. Shifted all of them two letters. So I get N, S, K, T, though not an English word. And I keep repeating that until I've check all the keys, because there are just 25 different keys. And then here at the bottom, you'll find the word information. Ah, that is an English word. So apparently, well, I had to shift 23 positions. Actually, I had to shift 3 positions backward then. That's the same. So apparently, in decryption, I have to use K is 3. So in encryption, K is 3 is used. I have the value of K, I shift everything 3 positions back, and actually you get an English text. Yeah, I totally agree with you. Looking at frequencies is something that we could have done. So there we're back there. So that's actually my second solution. I will teach you that anyway. So if I'm doing this, then the statistics are not changed in the text. Why? What's the most common letter in English? E. So if E is always changed to a fixed letter, I don't know which one, then probably, the text that I showed you is just an example, but most likely the letter that occurs very often, maybe not the most often, but very often in the ciphertext, represents the letter E. So let's see what happens then if we try that. Actually, E, E, T, A, I, O are the most common letters in English, the 5 most common letters. So here we have, just looking at English language, I'm not talking about my ciphertext yet. This is based on huge amounts of English text. You'll see slightly different statistics if you look at different sources, but yeah, this is a good representation of what the statistics in English text is. Yes, question. I can look at bigrams also. Yeah, I can look at the statistics of bigrams indeed also. Very good. But I don't need it here. It's too simple even. This is the statistic of the English text that I got from Wikipedia with some numbers attached to that. That's the same here. That is the statistics of my ciphertext. So E is occurring most. And here letter 23 is occurring most. I didn't put A, B, C underneath. What is 23? That's, W. So, is it likely that E is mapped to W? Apparently it was not. I'll show that. But I'm looking for similarities here. I'm looking for similarities in shape. And here? Nope. There. There you see a part of that, of my statistics of the ciphertext. with a very high probability, followed by two lower probabilities, and then again going up. And I actually see that occurring here also. A very high one, two lower ones, almost equal, and then two higher ones, similar also. These two shapes match. Actually here, that shape, two approximately of the same height, followed by flanked by two of which are lower. I see that here also. Actually, I could go one step beyond that because the next one is almost not present. That's here too. And the next one is somewhere in the middle, which is here, somewhere in the middle between these two, which is in the English text also. Yeah, and so from the English text to my ciphertext, I see that again, three positions shifted. So that's why I have to be careful. I can't just say E is the most occurring one, and this is the most occurring one, they match. So I have to look a bit further than that. I could have used bigrams also for that purpose. So here we have the same conclusion that the key is value 3 again, or D in this case. Okay, so Caesar cipher, it's not used anymore nowadays, except for kids wanting to send messages in some simple way. It's not used because simply too few keys. But I can bump up the number of keys. I can simply go from 26 keys to actually 26 factorial keys, which is a way bigger number. So how do I do that? Well, instead of saying if A is going to C, then B is going to D, and then C is going to F, yeah, everything in fixed position, I just take a random permutation of the alphabet. So here I have a random permutation of the alphabet, and here I have the regular alphabet, and then I say, okay, A is mapped to F. So A is shifting a number of positions in the alphabet, but B is mapped to N. B is shifted a different number of positions. So we're not shifting everything in the same number of positions. Everything gets his own mapping. So A is mapped to F, B to N, C to H, etc., etc. And then I use that in the encryption. So I have a text hello, I'll look up the H is mapped to, I don't know what letter here, yeah, and then the E is mapped to what letter, etc., etc. Still, statistics are there, but it's more difficult to do that. Decryption, yeah, this is encryption. Decryption is using going the other way around. So F in the ciphertext is mapped back to A in the plain text. N in the ciphertext is mapped back to B in the plaintext, etc. So that's the way then the decryption works. And that number here, the log 2 of that is 88.4. So we'll say that the entropy of this system is 88 bits, which is, in terms of the number itself, is a good number. But unfortunately, statistical attack work here also. But statistical attacks work poorly on text with just few words in there. So if the text becomes too small, statistics doesn't work. So here we have applied simple substitution, and we will not try to break that with statistics. You could do it if you want, but I'm not doing that. But I'll tell you something. I'll give you a hint. Now we are a bit further in the course already. I will tell you that this is a text on tempest testing. I'm pretty sure, does anybody know tempest testing?
No, tempest.
Okay, tempest testing is seeing if something is tempest-proof, so... Anyway, if you decrypt this, then you'll figure out. Why is this a useful hint? Well, if it's a text about tempest testing, I'm guessing tempest testing is actually in the text. Okay. So how does it help us? Yeah. But... Yeah, I can look at two seven letters because they're both seven letters. If I look at the beginning, this is three and this is more, so that will not match anyway. But even if it was a longer text and I had different occurrences of twice seven, there is something more about this, because tempest testing looks extremely nice. The first, the seventh, the eighth, and the 11th letter are the same. 1, 7, 8, 11. So that's an extra one. So if I have two seven-letter ciphertext words, I can also check this. Yeah. Also, the second, fifth, and ninth letter are all E's. So in the ciphertext, that should match also. E is mapped to a particular letter, one particular letter, and so that should still fit. The sixth and the tenth letters are the same. That's the S. And then the other five letters are unique. And then when I search, indeed, the text for this particular pattern, not just twice seven, which is a hint already, but even this extra, I will see that occurs there in the ciphertext. And so I can know that the plaintext T is mapped to the ciphertext I, and the plaintext E is mapped to the ciphertext Y, etc., etc. And then I can do the mapping it back, because then I will see tempest testing up here, but for example, what do we have? The Y here. I can also map that back to an E. Okay? There, I've done it. Still a lot of letters missing, right? It's hard to see here, but there is a green word there. What does it say there? Yeah, we can fill that in. Yeah. If there was doubt, well, this at the end of an English word is often tion. So this is an O. And if I would look back at the ciphertext word, there's an O there. And actually I get, which is represented by K in the ciphertext, I actually see that appearing here also. So indeed, more confirmation that information was the correct word. It was there, and then I make these changes based on what I learned, and I get more of the ciphertext. Now here in blue. Yeah. So you're learning a bit about what tempest is already, electromagnetic radiation, it says. Yeah, and then I get a lot of reconstruct here, and already, and, oh, here's a verb. Sorry? Leaves would be with an E in between. And left it would be leaked, yeah. Yeah, but I can simply test. Why also not the V? Is it? Leaped, yeah, leaped. That could be. Why not the P? I think the P was used already, or not? Yeah, it's a K, I know that. I wrote the text. but it could be leaps and leaped. It could be leaks and leaked. And maybe there are other possibilities too. But it could be, I don't see, oh yeah, here, P. P is used already. I know I have decrypted the letter P already. So it can't be a P here. Yeah? So that will give me additional information. I have the list of letters I haven't found back yet, and P wasn't in there. And so we continue, and then at some point we have the full text. Actually, in this text, you will see that we have 23 letters of the key. Is it a problem that we don't know the other three? How are these, man? Not in this text, of course. Yeah, these are not used here, and if I get another communication, maybe with the same key, at least I know 23 letters already, and yeah, if needed, I'll figure out the other three, or part of the other three later on. Okay, so simple substitution, again, is not a really secure system. If you have to do this by hand, of course, yeah, that adds a bit to the complexity of the problem, but not a lot. Yeah, a dedicated attacker, dedicated Eve will not be fooled. Caesar cipher and simple substitution, those are so-called monoalphabetic ciphers. One letter is mapped to another letter, always in the same manner. A is always mapped to F, no matter where in the plain text it occurs. You also have, alternatively, you have polyalphabetic ciphers. Then an A can map the first time to the F, and the second time to H, and the third time to N, and the fourth time maybe again to F. Can repeat, of course. But it can map to more different letters. So one of the examples of a polyalphabetic cipher is the Visionaire system. Actually, Visionaire is nothing more or less than R repeated Caesar ciphers. And the key now is not a single letter. The key now is a word, and a word consisting of R letters in this case. So how does it work? I have a plain text. Visionaire cipher is polyalphabetic. That's not a word, I just removed the spaces. And I have a key, and the key is crypto. And just keep repeating the key over and over again. So crypto, 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 etc., etc. And then I'm doing the encryption. V plus C equals X. Yeah, C represented by 2, so I have to go 2 places further on in the alphabet. V, W, X. I plus R is Z, G plus Y is E, etc., etc. So that's how Visionaire works, and once I get to the end of my key, I'll start over with the first letter of the key again. Caesar cipher was easily broken, looking at statistics. If I would know the length of the key in the Visionaire system, I actually could break it. I just look at all the ciphertext bits, the ciphertext letters that are encrypted with the same key. So that's the first one, and then the R plus first one, and then the 2R plus first one, etc. Or I look at the second one, and the 2R plus, second one, or the 2R plus, I'll just take out the letters that are encrypted with the same key. So here, the V and the R and the E and the L and the A are encrypted with the same key. These letters, obviously less than the total letters of the plain text they have, but that set of letters follows the normal distribution of English text. So all the ciphertext will do that too. And again, I can use statistics on that to find back what that apparently that key letter is a C. Yeah? And once I've done that, I'll go to the other ones. Again, all of those letters in the ciphertext are encrypted with the same letter. Yeah? And so the statistics on these plain text follows the same distribution as the English language, and so does the ciphertext, the red ones. So if I know the length of the key, it's done. But I don't have the length of the key yet. Yeah, and if I test a lot of things, then I it might take a long time. That we said already. The length of a Visionaire key is actually also easy to extract. There is a technique called incidence of coincidences or index of coincidences that will easily tell you that. How it works is interesting reading. For those who are interested in that, Google this and look at the information that I put here. But I put it in gray, so it's not part of the curriculum. You don't have to know this. How it exactly works. You have to know the name. Could ask for the name on the test, but I'm not asking for how does the incidence of coincidences work. Then actually there is one version of the Visionaire system that is secure. And that's a specific version that's called the Vernon system or the one-time pad. And what I do there is just make sure that my key is as long as my plain text. So what was the problem with Visionaire? I have a key, and the first letter of the plain text is encrypted with the first letter of the key, and then the first letter of the key is used again later on, multiple times. If I make sure that I don't reuse that first letter of the key just by making the key longer and longer and longer, as long as the plain text, I can't use that particular attack, right? So the length of the key, if it is the same as the length of the plain text, no key letters are reused, and so that statistical attack cannot work. So here's an example. We have Alice. Alice wants to talk to Bob. Yeah, and Alice wants to give an instruction to Bob. She wants to tell him give. And she has a key, some random key, UNMR, and then using that big table, she gets to a ciphertext, AVHV. Yeah? And a ciphertext, that's secure. This is intelligible information. Everybody knows what this means. This is unintelligible information. Yeah? So she's sending that ciphertext over to Bob. But then Eve comes, and Eve sees the ciphertext. Eve has no idea what's hidden here. But she has a ciphertext. And she knows the crypto system that's used, Phenom system. And so what she does is she guesses a key. Right? And here is a key that she guessed. A, B, C, D. Okay, then she can do same as before. Look at the key bits, find a particular ciphertext bit, and find then the plaintext bit. Yeah, we discussed that before. And she gets as plain text ACGY. Well, that's not an English word. Okay, that's a hint for her. So this is apparently not the key that Alice used. Alice is not going to tell Bob ACJY. Okay, she knows that key is wrong. So this is not correct. Obviously, Eve knows that because that is not an English word. Okay, let's give her another try. She has enough time so she can try keys as she wants. Here she has a key. TFDJ. And she's doing decryption again, and she comes to take. Yes, I know what Alice is telling Bob. Take, because I just found an English word. Right? She can find any message, in fact. Any message that you want, any four-letter message that you can put here, I can find a key that decrypts to that message. Decrypts this ciphertext to that message. Very easy. Bob, however, so we see that it is wrong. Bob, however, he knows the key. There's Bob. He knows the key. Because Alice and Bob were sitting together, and Alice said, yeah, maybe in the future I want to send you a message. We will use this key. Keep it secret. Bob and Alice have that key. And so Bob sits down, starts doing the decryption. And actually Bob gets to GIF. Which is correct. So Bob clearly knows the difference between taking and giving. That's good. Yeah? There it is. Bob really understood the message from Alice. Yeah? Eve had no idea. Bob knows it. So this system, Phenom or one-time pad, that's actually the only secure crypto system that exists. Completely impractical, but the only secure one. If used correctly, it is secure. Unfortunately, just go to the Wikipedia link, unfortunately there are examples where it was used incorrectly. So you have the best system ever, key was repeated, well then, I can break it. Hotline between Washington and Moscow. That's where they use it. That's where the one-time pad is used. So what I now have to do, if I'm in one of the cities and I wanted to talk to the other one, if I'm in Washington, I want to talk to Moscow, I have to first make a key, and then go to the other place, hand them the key, go back home, use that key to decrypt to encrypt the message, and then send that message. And I don't have to deliver the message. I can just send it in the visible for everybody. Is that reasonable? In many cases, I would just take the message and go there and say, hey, this is the message. The reason why they use it is in case of emergencies. Yeah, I suppose that Putin or Trump is leaning on a table and is pressing some red button. That in the case of emergencies, they have a secure communication. Oh, oops. Oopsie daisy. I made a mistake. Right? So that's why they distribute the key before and then use it afterwards. Here is one last crypto system that I will... I will get to some more recent one later on. But this is an old one that was used. I'm not sure about the time. I'll do this one and then we'll have a break. Transpositions. Transpositions are also very simple. What I'll do is I'll have a block of, let's say, 5 letters. And I'll just permute those letters. So I have a fixed permutation. And so, for example, 35214, if I'm looking at NS5. And then I take a plain text, cryptographical. I break it up in parts of five. And then I'm doing the permutation. The permutation is 35214. So here's the 1. So I'll take this letter first, and then this letter, and then this letter, and then that one, and that one. So this will be PYCTR. And here it will be AROPG. And ACHLI. That's all. And then I'll put it all together again. Why don't I send it like this? Well, then at least somebody knows that I used NS5. Yeah, well, stick it all together again. At least that is a bit more secure. Now it's done with a line of text. I can also do matrices of text. Let's do that here. We'll write the text into this matrix row-wise. So I'll start writing it row-wise, and I will be reading it back column-wise according to the permutation. So here we have a text again. Information security is an exciting topic for study, which it is. Can't deny that. We'll put it in the matrix column-wise. Row-wise. Information security is an exciting topic for study. KCDYYOB. I didn't fill up that last matrix, so I'll just put random letters there. Yeah, and once one matrix is full, I go to the next one. And then I look at the permutation again, and then I read out the columns according to the permutation. So it will be OICYE, FTETAN, etc., etc. Yeah? That's this column, and that's this column, etc., etc. That's how it works. Decryption is not that complicated, just work the other way around. The question? Yeah?
In transposition, in the previous slide, where we had the fixed sequence of letters,
yeah?
I didn't get that part. As per the numbers that you mentioned, I think it was not the same, or I didn't get it right.
No. Here. Yeah? So if I look at the permutation, 35214, I look at a set of 5 letters, and then I look at the permutation. Where is the 1? That's here. That is corresponding to this letter. And then the second, the 2 is there, so that corresponds to this letter. 3 is this letter. 4 and 5. So it will be PYCTR, which is PYCTR. So the permutation tells me it's not used in the normal sense. It's telling me the 1 in the permutation is telling me which number to take first. Yeah, same as actually here. Yeah, the permutation, it's the same permutation by the way, is telling me which column to read first. Yeah, so don't assume if you know about permutation, don't use it in the same way. Not use the 3rd and then the 5th and then the 2nd and the 1st and then the 4th letter. It's going the other way around. Yeah. So decryption is going the other way around. So here we have a particular ciphertext and a permutation. And then actually we'll have a break now. And then the question after the break is, what was the plain text? Yeah? Let's have a, it's 11:10 now. Let's start at 11:25 again. Any questions so far? If not, and I was very clear or very unclear. Okay, and we'll start again. Did you manage to decrypt? Yeah, who did? Yeah, oh, well done, I'm proud of you. That was actually the text. So I take the first five letters and I write them in this column indicated by one in the permutation, and the second one, etc., etc., and then I read it out row-wise again. Well done, I'm very proud of you. So that was indeed the plain text that I had. I had added some interpunction there. That was the last, let's say, really classical crypto system. We'll now go to two systems that are used in the not so long past. These two are called rotor machines. This is a Swedish one, the Hagelin, and this is the German one, the Enigma. Does anybody know the meaning of the word Enigma? Enigma means riddle. So the idea here is that this was used by the Germans in the Second World War. The idea was that it was very secure, but it was broken, in fact, by the English. About that in a second something. So why is it called rotor machines? Well, I'll go back one side. Here are three rotors, and here in the Hagelin are a number of rotors. And what is a rotor? A rotor is just two disks, and in between these disks are wires. There are 26 inputs in one disk and 26 inputs in the other, or outputs, whatever. Yeah, and then there is a random wiring between the two. And it's called also rotor because it rotates. Every time that a letter is encrypted, one rotor will shift one position. Once it has shifted all the positions, the next rotor will shift one position. It's like the in your car, when you look at the distance that you have driven, once you've driven a kilometer, one of the numbers will go up. Once it reaches 10, the number before that will go up. So that's how it works. And it's simply, there is a wiring inside the rotor. So in this case, if the rotor is in this position, the E will be mapped to the B. Then the rotor shifts, so everything is shifting, it's round. So everything will shift down, but then this particular connection will be here, and the next time an E will be mapped to an E. So it will change all of the time. This is actually from the Enigma. If you look here at it's difficult to see, at the front of the board, there is something called Stecker. There are 26 openings, and you had, I think, up to 5 or 10 or something different permutations of letters. So you could, a swapping of letters. So you could plug in two letters with a cable, and then those two letters would be swapped. So for example, here, this letter would be swapped, and there is a big cross here. So that's just swapping of letters. Not random mapping, but swapping of letters. And then we had the three rotors at the top of the machine, and then we had what is called Umkehrwalzer, in German, probably not pronounced very well, but then actually the electrical signal is returning through the three rotors again, through the Stecker, and then up. So there is a keyboard there. Keyboard is connected here. So if I type a letter, there will be an electrical current flowing through this diagram, and back, and then actually when it comes out here, it's not going back to the key I pressed, but there are 26 light bulbs there, and they will light up. And actually now the cover is open. If you close the cover, these light bulbs will light up one particular letter. So what happened? Somebody was typing on it, so he typed one letter, and then he had to write down which the encrypted letter was. And then he typed the next letter, and he had to write down what the encrypted. So actually it was kind of offline encryption. He had the plain text, he just typed it and make note of the ciphertext, and then the ciphertext could be used to transmit. So here's what's happening, for example, if this particular letter is typed, then there is current going through the Stecker first, and then into the first rotor, which randomly permutes, or not randomly, but based on the internal wiring. It's going there. And then through the second one and third one. And then here at the end it's turned around. And then it follows the stream back all the way to apparently this output letter. Yeah. Once that is done, this rotor will make one click. Once this rotor has done 26 clicks, it's back in the original position, then this one will make one click, etc. So if I would type A now and I get out this one, if I would then type A again, it would never end up at the same position, the same output letter, which was actually a weakness of this system. These rotors can be shifted out. I think there were 5 rotors in total, so the choice of which is the left, middle, and right rotor was part of the setup of the system, part of the key, so to say. That was a question.
Yeah, so every time somebody was pressing a letter,
yeah,
he would write what was the output.
Yeah.
And then if he presses it the next time, then he again writes. So he would tell that at first frequency or at the first instant when it's A, then it's this letter. The next time when it's
letter gave it repeats, then
it's this letter.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so if I type hello, I type H and I look, okay, the letter P is the light of P is burning. Okay, I write down P. And then I type E and then I say, okay, the A is lit up. So I write A. L, and I do that letter by letter. Yeah, and at the end, instead of hello as plain text, I have something as a ciphertext, and that is then given to somebody who is using a telegraph to send it to somebody else. Yeah, so the communication line and the encryption algorithm were completely separated. Here is some information. This YouTube video really explains the Enigma in a lot of detail. Just watch it and then you'll see that. I think he also says a bit about why the Enigma was broken. Actually, what you saw from the first slide, A will actually never be mapped. Yeah, to what? A will never be mapped to
A.
A. Any letter will never be mapped back to itself. And that was a weakness. And it was a weakness because in the beginning of the day, they had to check if the communication was correct, and so they encrypted the text, and they encrypted, say, the letter T. I'm not sure if it was a correct letter. They just started hitting T over and over again, and then writing down the output, and then sending that over, and then on the other side they could check if they get all the T's. And then if they get back all the T's, they could see that the settings on the two sides was the same. Because if they would have swapped these two rotors, then they would got something different, of course. And so they could check, are our settings correct? But by using that, actually there was a lot of information that was gained by the English. This one is a link to a teaser for what was the name? The Imitation Game. Very, very interesting movie. Just if you have the opportunity, just go and see it. Questions? Yeah. Then you get an error, yeah.
Yeah, and you would always get it. You would never solve that first A if you need it.
It's not just the A, because then the rest of the text would be nonsense.
Yeah, okay.
So as soon as I forget to write down one letter in the ciphertext, or I forget one letter when decrypting it,
yeah,
it will all be nonsense from there on.
Yeah?
So there's no error correction. There are systems where if there is an error, it will be very local, and it will correct itself afterwards, but in this case it was game over. Yeah, they needed to send it again or something, or to decrypt it again or whatever. Go back to the initial settings, start decrypting, see if it was on the receiving side an error. If not, then they had to call back to the other side, to the sender side, and see if they got the correct, if they got an error in sending the encrypted text over. Other questions? Okay, Then that was, let's say, the classical crypto systems. Let's see if it's here. Yeah. There we are. Symmetric crypto system. So if we go back to the content, we have covered the historical crypto systems, and now we're going over to classical crypto systems. To symmetric crypto system. Why? There are two types of crypto systems, symmetric and asymmetric. Why is a symmetric system called symmetric system? That is in the key. The key is symmetric. The key that the sender uses and the key that the receiver uses is exactly the same. The symmetry is in that part. That means that in general, not always, but in general, the encryption algorithm and the decryption algorithm will be linked, of course, but they will not be exactly the same. Can be the same, but not necessarily. We'll see both cases. So here, the trouble is, Alice and Bob need the same key. They need exactly the same key. If there is an error in the key that Bob has, then everything will go wrong. What's more, if Alice and Bob have that key, and Eve has the same key, stole it or whatever, then Eve can do exactly the same as Alice and Bob. So the key is of high value. Opposite to what we'll see in asymmetric crypto later on. The key is of very... So we have to keep the key secret. So symmetric crypto is also called secret key crypto. So anybody who has the key can do whatever Alice and Bob can. But now there is a problem in key distribution. Yeah, there are 30 people here. So if I want to communicate in a secure manner to each of you, I have to make sure that each of you has a key different from the other ones. And I have a bunch of 30 keys, and if I want to send a message to you, I have to figure out where is that particular key. Because if I use his key, then things go wrong. And I think I'm sending something in confidence to you while he can read it, and you can't, in fact. Here are some examples. Data encryption standard, advanced encryption standard, A51, and IDEA, those are all in this category of symmetric crypto. Well, let's try to make it a bit more visible of what actually symmetric crypto is. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to share keys. And I'm going to share keys with different persons. So different keys. So I have here one key. And this key is for Alice. So you play Alice now. This is the key. I have a copy of the key too, so don't worry, but don't show it to him. Yeah? It's your key. And I have another key. Visually, they are different already. So this is the key I will use with Bob. And let's see. Let's find a Bob. Any Bob in the room? Not? Right, you can play Bob. I've been answering a couple of questions, so you got the honor of playing Bob. Well, we had Alice and Bob, but we had more people, right? You remember that from the last hour. We also have Carol. So Carol has a different key again. Try not to fall. Let's see, Carol. Carol was sitting up here. You're a bit of packed in, but make sure that the other guys... her key. Carol's key, not your key. That was Carol. So, who's next? Dave. Exactly. Who was Dave? Somebody said Dave. Wasn't up there. So, oh, you said Dave. Okay, Dave gets... No, Dave. Now I made a mistake. Apologies. Bob, I want my key back. You haven't looked at it, have you?
No.
Okay, good. No, I haven't. Sorry, I'm messing up. Bob, can I see your key, Alice? That's your key. Bob, can I see your key? That's your correct key also. Carol. Oh, apologies, Carol. I shouldn't have given you such a big key. I'll give you a smaller key. Right? You haven't looked at it. Good. That's your key. This was Dave's key. And Dave is sitting here, first row, second row. Yeah, so Dave is getting this key. And then I have one more key. Let me check if that's correct. Yeah, this is Alice's, Eve's key. Who's Eve? Who wants to play Eve? I'll go Eve. Well, problem is there are not that many Eves in the room, possible Eves in the room. I'll make you Eve. Sure. So now I shared, you saw a lot of work, right? And you saw that I even made mistakes. That was not intentionally, by the way. But key distribution was a big hassle. So now I want to share a message with Alice. Now Alice has to listen for once. So the message that I want to say, I can't tell you, it's confidential. Yeah? But I used my key, the key that I share with Alice, and I used that to actually encrypt the message. And the message, the encrypted message is this. Anybody now already know what I'm telling Alice? I guess not. Anybody dare to pronounce? No, me neither. So before we get to Alice, let's get to Bob first. Bob, that's you. You see the resemblance, or? Bob, can you tell me what I'm trying to tell Alice? So just for the ones at home, Bob is now looking in a dictionary and is trying to look up this text. If everything is well, he is on page 149. Are you, Bob? T-U-R. Thought it was around 149. No. Oh, that's great. So Bob's key is apparently not capable of decrypting my secret message. That's great, because Bob's key and the key I share with Bob, I should say, and the key I share with Alice should be different. So let's go to Carol. Carol is on page 306? Yeah. I can read minds. Carol, how about you? Can you tell me what I'm telling Alice? I'm trying to tell Alice. No? Cool. That's good. So let's go to Dave. And Dave, actually, I can tell you, Dave is looking like this, because Dave got the Russian-Norwegian, and Russians are using the Cyrillic script. So reading that dictionary is a major pain. Yeah. You should, it's around page 1089 or 1090 or something like that, yeah? But anyway, it should not be in there. That's cool. Then Eve, you should be able to find it. That's Eve's job. So what is the word that we are looking for? What is the message? You don't know? Oh, cool. Well, then let's go and see if the main person here now can tell me what I'm trying to tell her. It's a Finnish Norwegian. You're not Norwegian. Maybe I should have done that differently. Sorry. Sorry. Can you spell it? Yeah? I think you should stop now. Seek ahead. That was indeed the message. So Alice indeed tells me seek ahead. Yeah? So now I've shown you that I had different keys for different persons. Alice, Bob, Carol, Dave, and Eve. None of them could understand the message that I was sending to Alice because I used my special key with Alice. I could have had the same message. Oh, wait, I have to show that, of course. Yeah, I'm not fooling anybody. I actually could have also decrypted secret for all the other ones. It would look completely different. And again, I'm not trying to pronounce any of those. So in Turkish and in German and in Russian, again, with you can see now Dave's confusion, of course, right? And in Spanish it is. So different keys will give me different ciphertext, even if the message is the same. Yeah, the algorithm was the same in all cases. I have a message word, I look it up in the dictionary, and I find the corresponding ciphertext. Yeah?
So in case different people have asymmetric keys, and then you have to send a message multiple times to everybody?
Oh, okay. If I understand correctly, if I want to send a message to Bob and Alice, then yes, I have to find something such that it is encrypted once for Bob and once for Alice, right? Generally, how this is done, this is outside the scope of this course, but generally how that is done is I'll use one encryption algorithm and I generate a random key for that, and then I encrypt that key with Alice's key and with Bob's key, because the text could be very long, and I don't want to encrypt that twice, once with Alice's key and once with Bob's key. I want to encrypt it once, and then just have the key that I use for that encrypted for both persons. Yeah? Okay. Was this clear? Yeah? Good. So that's symmetric crypto, in a nutshell. Let's go to stream ciphers. More, less dictionaries there, but more mathematical, more technical. A stream cipher, I wrote here, is related to the Venom cipher. Remember from just before the break, Venom was a system where every letter was encrypted with its own letter. The key was as long as the plain text, right? So that's what we do here also. Every bit, if I see the message, the plain text as a stream of bits, every bit is encrypted with its own random key bit. And if I make sure that my key stream is completely random and not repeated, then I have a secure system. The encryption algorithm is simple. Yeah, before we had modulo 26 addition of letters, here we have XOR, which is in principle a modulo 2 addition. Yeah, give that a bit of thought. So if I have a plain text bit and I have a key bit, I just XOR the two together to find the ciphertext bit. The receiver will do the other way around. He will receive the ciphertext bit on the communication channel, and he has the key bit also. He XORs them together, and he gets a plain text bit. And obviously the question again is, do I get back to the same value? Well, I think that's clear. It doesn't need any explanation anyway. So, okay. So the only thing I have to do is generate a long enough, random, completely random key stream. Yeah, I write down my message, I write down the key stream below it, I'll do XORs, and I get a ciphertext that I can send. So what's the problem in this situation? Well, there are maybe two problems. Generating a completely random string of bits, that's nearly impossible. I can do it, but it's difficult. I can't rely just on software, I need to rely on hardware things. But even if I do that, I have to make sure that the receiver gets the same string. He can't generate the same string, because it's completely random. Yeah. So then I have a trouble of getting that stream there. So what we do actually is generate something that looks random. It isn't random, but it looks random. a random-looking string using what is called a linear feedback shift register, LFSR. And your assignment, assignment one, I will talk about that in a minute, will be on LFSRs. Why is the output of an LFSR random or random-looking? We'll get back to that later. Here we have one. This is a linear feedback shift register. Let me see what I wrote about that. Each of these squares contains a bit. 1 bit exactly. So we have 7 bits here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. We have 7 bits here. And in each step, or in each clock, every time that we clock the LFSR, what happens is that some of these bits, these 3 bits, the value of these 3 bits is fed back here into this position. So that's where the feedback comes from. Linear comes from the fact that these are linear operations. Register because I have a register, linear feedback, shift register because the contents of the register shifts. So let's look at an example, make it graphically more interesting. Here we have the same LFSR as before. We have filled it with 7 bits. Each square contains 1 bit. And now we're going to clock this LFSR, or step it, whatever you want to call it. So this is the first one. This zero is being pushed out and is going around and ending up there. The one here, so ending up there. And then these two are XORed. And the result being 1. So the 1 is as output of the XOR. 1 and this 1, or XORed again, that will result in a 0. So the 0 is coming here. So that's the feedback. I just calculated on the current settings, I just calculated what the feedback would be. Then I'm going to shift it. And so when shifting it, maybe one step back. Look at the content. Write it down for to be sure. 1 0 1 0 1 1 0. That's the content. So I'm going to shift it. Shift it at one position, and I still have 1 0 1 0 1 1 1. And this zero, which was there, is now pushed out. That's the output bit, the key bit that I'm going to use. Well, now I have an empty spot, but luckily I had the feedback calculated, and so this zero is being pushed in on that side. That's all a linear feedback shift register does. It looks at the content, it calculates the feedback, and then everything is shifted and the feedback is coming in and 1 bit is pushed out, which is the key bit. That's a question. There is an arrow, the arrow points where it is going. I will say something about how an LFSR looks in a few seconds. Is the procedure, is that clear? Yeah? No. That's the design. Yeah. In this case, in this LFSR, this is, you can see this as hardwired. Yeah? So always the first, the fifth, and the seventh bit are XORed. I can do whatever I want. Yeah? I'm a professor. No. We'll also look into different settings. And obviously, this is a very short one, so it doesn't really provide security also. So the new content here, the new content is, well, these are here was the other one. These 3 bits XORed, which is the new, in this case, left-hand side bit, and then these 6 bits are here at the end. So the 7 bits on the left side shift 1 position to the right. And the rightmost bit, that was a 0, is push out. I will skip over the exercises. We can do that in the afternoon if you want. Don't look at it. Oh, there it is. So this is the linear feedback shift register that I just used. Remember, the first, the fifth and the seventh bit are being used to create the feedback. This is exactly the same linear feedback shift register, except that where I just said the new bit is pushed in from the left-hand side, now it's pushed in from the right-hand side. Yeah, so this block here is the same as this block here in this drawing. Yeah, and the second block here is the same as this one there, etc., etc. All I did is take that picture and turn it upside down. No magic tricks. Yeah? Just follow where the arrows are going. That's the easiest way to remember. I can turn it upside down also, yeah, so that the feedback is, again, on top of the register. No magic. Everything is exactly the same here. Three identical linear feedback shift registers. Again, I can slightly draw it in a different way. I can take these squares and I can take them a bit apart and then I just draw arrows between them. Same thing is happening. The bit that was here is now there. The bit that was here is going there. The bit, the first, the fifth, and the seventh bit were used to calculate the feedback. The first, three, four, the fifth, and the seventh bit are used to calculate the feedback. No difference. Here you see that the feedback comes from the top of this box. I can simply say that it comes from this line. There is a value in here, and if I push it out here and there, or if I push it out here and it splits, doesn't really matter. Everything is exactly the same. So don't be confused if it looks slightly different. Just try to imagine what is happening. There are values in this box. Every time that the linear feedback shift register clocks or steps, whatever you want to call it, values are pushed out and going over these electrical lines, because a bit is just an electrical current. Right, that's all. Clear? Okay. This is a linear feedback shift register. Why was it linear? Well, these operations are linear, right? So we have also a general feedback shift register, or feedback shift register in general. Same drawing, right? See that? I have a number of boxes, and there are lines between these boxes, but that doesn't really matter. And there are lines there going up. So if the content of this one, or let's say this one, is when it steps, is pushed there and pushed there. Nothing really exciting. Except now that here at the top, this feedback, see this feedback, because the output of this one is pushed in here again. That feedback is now not a set of XORs, but a general function. And actually this function, I call it F, doesn't need to be linear at all. The only requirement that I have for this particular function is that it takes in n different bits, and from that it outputs, it calculates one bit that it outputs. So we have a function, f, that takes in n bits, a string of n bits, and outputs a single bit. And that bit is fed back, so it's still a feedback shift register. That bit is calculated and sent back. So we talk about linear feedback shift register if this function is linear. And if this function is linear, I can actually write it in as XORs of some of these bits. I don't need to take all of these bits. If I take a CI value, which is zero, then actually this is ignored, and zero times whatever bit value it has, 0, 1, will be 0, and XORing something with 0 doesn't matter. Yeah. So if CI is 0, then a particular bit is not taken into this feedback. If CI is 1, then 1 times a 0 is 1, leave that value undisturbed. Yeah. So actually the CI values, C0 up to CN minus 1, they tell me something if, is this bit taken in the feedback or not? So if this is my feedback function, S0 plus XOR S2 XOR X6, that means the first bit is taken, and the second bit is taken, and the sixth bit is taken. So for example, in this particular case, S0 XRS2, XRS6, those are all taken. Taken back into the feedback. Yeah, I'll skip this formalization. That's just mathematical notation, not that important. So this is here I have the feedback shift register again, and we have the bits that are in the feedback shift register, a linear feedback shift register actually. And now the CIs are actually as switches. A CI equal to 0 means that the switch is open. That bit is not considered for the feedback. And a CI equal to 1 means that switch is closed and that bit value is taken into the feedback. And we always assume that the first one is closed. Why is that? Suppose that this one is not taken into consideration, then actually it's just delaying the output one bit. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't change anything of the key stream. So that's why we assume that this one is always closed. So what happens? Okay, suppose I have this simple linear feedback shift register. The length is 4. The feedback is only from S0 and S1 into the back. And suppose that at some point I have 1000 linear. So this is 1, this is 0, this is 0, and this is 0. And now I'll step it one step. I'll clock it one step. What will happen? Well, these three zeros, they will move, right? The 1 and the 0 are XORed and fed back to the end. So the three zeros are moved to the front, to the left in this case, and the 1 is fed in at the right end. So from 1000, I will go to a situation where it is 0001. Okay, let's step it again. Okay, these three bits are moved, and these two are XORed, and that will result in 0. So, this one. And again, these three bits are moved, and these two are XORed together there. I get this one. Quite boring until now. Now it gets more exciting. These three bits are moved, and these two are XORed. So now I'll finally get more than one in there. Yeah, and I can just keep repeating that, and at some point I get to here. 1100. Okay, let's see what happens now. I'll take these three, and I move them there. And these two ones are XOR, that results in a 0. That's there. 1000. What's special about 1000? Yeah, exactly, I'm back. What will be, I didn't write it here. What will be the next one? Yeah, it starts again, right? So there's no magic. It's not like one time it will go to this new setting and the next time it will go somewhere else. Yeah. So I will start over again. So actually I could forget about this last one and I'll go from there to there and then start over again. So I'm cycling around. There were 15, I can show that. 15 different values. So from 0 up to 14, those are 15 different fillings of the content. What would happen if I would have started with 0000? Yeah. All of these zeros at the end will move there, and whatever feedback I have, not just in this case, but whatever feedback I have is just XORing a lot of zeros together. That will always be 0, and so I get a 0 at the end. So in any LFSR, not just in this one, in any LFSR, if the content is all zeros, every step will just output a 0, yeah, because there is output also, and the setting will be all zeros again. Yeah, because it's a linear function. Yeah. If it's a general, if you have a general feedback function, you can use also product or whatever you want. Yeah. So in this particular, for this particular linear feedback shift register, if I start in the all zero state, I will stay in the all zero state for all eternity. If I start in any other state, doesn't matter this one, any other state, I will just cycle around all 15 other states. How many states are there in total? Well, two possibilities for a bit here, two to the power 4, 16 different contents of this LFSR, 1 plus the other 15. Then, going back to random, because actually we were going to use the linear feedback shifts register to generate a random string. Not a random string, because it's not really random, but a pseudo noise sequence. And a pseudo noise sequence is actually generated by an LFSR that, for where the output of the LFSR is of length, has period 2 to the power n minus 1. Like here, 2 to the power 4 minus 1. Before it returns to the original state, and then it repeats itself. Yeah. So I can't do any better than that, right? I can't go through all the states and just get back after 30 times or whatever. I have to get back at most after 2 to the power 4 minus 1, after 15 times in this case. Can't do any better than that. So a bit of theory about that. Here we have the same LFSR. Do you agree? I'll have the... This was the one that I draw before, and I have it in this form. Do you agree that that's the same? Yeah? I just took these boxes slightly apart, and then I turned it around. That's all. Nothing more, nothing less. So there we have. We are now going to define what the generator polynomial of this linear feedback shift register is. Okay? I have a 1 here. Why? Because there is feedback here. I have a 1 there, because there is feedback here. There is a 0. There's no feedback here. There is a 0. There's no feedback here. There is a 1, because actually the feedback is coming back in again. There's a question?
In the previous step, we had the pseudo noise.
Yeah? Yeah.
What is the value that is included in that, and why do we use pseudo?
Okay, let's go back a bit. Oh, there. So this was all the states. I didn't exactly tell that, but these are all the states of the values S0 to S3. I should also have mentioned the output bit, because when I go from this state to this state, actually this bit was pushed out. And if I go from this state to this state, this bit is pushed out. So actually, these bits are all pushed out, right? So the output of this particular LFSR, if I start in this initial state, is 1 0 0 0 1 0 0 1 1 0 1 0 1 1 1, and then it starts from the top again. So that's the output of the linear feedback shift register. I didn't really mention it. That's a binary sequence of length 15. And then when I take that sequence and I keep on going, I have to just repeat it over and over again. So that is what I say here. Output, so now I'm talking about the output, the bits that I just mentioned, of has a period of 2 to the power n minus 1. N is the length of this LFSR, so 4 in this case. So 2 to the power 4 minus 1 is 15. Yeah. So this particular, we'll see different cases later on. In this particular case, I see 15 bits, and then I see the same 15 bits again. I can't look at a shorter sequence and say this is repeating already. Yeah. We'll get to examples of linear feedback shift register that actually start repeating earlier on already. Yeah. And obviously, what I want is as repetition as late as possible, right? To assure that Fermat system that the length of the key stream is as long as the length of the plain text without repetition. Yeah? If I would in this case have a message of length 10, that would work. If I have a message of length 15, now let's say 20, yeah, then I have to repeat key bits. And then it's no longer a good system. Let me see where we were. Yeah. So I just explained these coordinates. And then I make it into a polynomial, x to the power 0, x to the power 1. And then I get a degenerate polynomial, x to the power 4 plus x to the power 1 plus x to the power 0, which is simply equal to 1. Yeah, so turn around, it says 1 plus x plus x to the power 4. This is called the generator polynomial. In general, if I have different feedbacks, I get a different polynomial. Right? If the feedback would be not here, but here, then it would be 1 from the first one. This would be 0. This would be x squared, because this was 1. And this would be there, and this would be out. And the x to the power 4, the highest power, is always there, because there is feedback coming back in. That results in this x to the power 4. Anyway, when you see a linear feedback shift register, you are now able to write down the generator polynomial. So why is the generator polynomial of importance? Suppose that in the case that I just said, so I don't have feedback from the first and the second, but from the first and the third bit. Yeah, the feedback polynomial would the generator polynomial would be 1 plus x squared plus x to the power 4. Actually, if I look at that particular polynomial, I can split it into two second-degree polynomials. Just do the calculation yourself and you'll figure it out. Remember, everything is done modulo 2. Yeah, so all the calculations. If I am in such a case that indeed my generator polynomial can be split into smaller polynomials, product of smaller polynomials, then I am in a state where actually the length of the output sequence depends on, well, the initial state that I started in. Of course, if I start in 0, I will always go back to 0. Right? In this particular case, if I would start in 0, 1, 1, 0, these three bits are shifted, right, there. And the output is the sum of the first and the third. The feedback is the sum of the first and the third, 0, 1. XOR together will be a 1. These three bits are shifted again. These two bits, XOR to a 1, that's there. Then these two bits are shifted here, 0, 1, 1. And then the XOR is based on the two 1s, which XOR together to 0. So I'm back here again. Yeah? So here I have a period of length 3, because the output bits, as I said, is 0, 1, 1. And then it gets back here, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. The output has a period of 3. If I would start in this particular state, just try it for yourself, you will see that 2, 4, 6, I actually have a period of length 6 before I get back to the origin. Yeah, and in this particular case also. So, depending on the start state, forget about this one, this is an exception. But depending on the start state, the period could be of different length. If I have, on the other hand, an irreducible polynomial, which means that I have a polynomial that I can't split into smaller polynomials, product of smaller polynomials, then there are two cases, actually. In this particular case, I will show you that here is the L of Zar, by the way. In this particular case, I will show you that all, independent of the initial state, all will have the same length. All output sequences will have the same length. This one is, again, the exception. But these are the other three. And all of them have length 5. Yeah. So if I start in this state, I will cycle here and then go back, and etc. If I would start in this state, by the way, same thing. After 5 steps, I'm back. Yeah. So independent of the initial state, in this particular case, after 5 steps, I'm back in the origin. So now all sequences that are generated independent of the starting state will have a period of length 5. So that was an irreducible polynomial. But some of these irreducible polynomials are special. They are called primitive. And if I start with a primitive polynomial, as in this particular case, the one that we saw before, then actually I will just have one cycle, except for the all zero cycle. I will just have one cycle that cycles through all the states. And in that case, I'll say that the output is a PN sequence, a pseudo-noise sequence. Okay. Questions about that so far? Well, first of all, if you have a polynomial, it should be irreducible. And then it's just a matter of seeing if it generates a full cycle. Yeah? That's the only thing that we can do. We can't... you can't say otherwise if it's primitive or not. Other questions? I now realize that I should have given you the assignment. Maybe I will just close this and open the assignment. If I can find it. Assignment 1. Yeah. So let me quickly do this before we have a break. Assignment 1, as I said, is on crypto. And in fact, I will ask you to implement the A51 algorithm. The A51 algorithm is a part of the GSM algorithm. So your mobile phone uses this algorithm. It looks like this. This is actually a set of 3 linear feedback shift registers, where in particular the first one has length 19, and there are a number of bits, 4 bits that are fed back into the end. Second one is relatively simple, just the first 2 bits of the 22 bits are fed back, etc., etc. The interesting idea about the A51 algorithm is that not all 3 LFSR need to step. Whenever an output bit is created, this bit and this bit and this bit are XORed. But then these are the clocking bits. If all 3 have the same value, all 3 are 0 or all 3 are 1, then all 3 will step in the same way as we discussed before. If this has a different value than these 2, then only these 2 will step. This will stay in the same position. The output bit will be used anyway, even if the content of the register doesn't change. The output bit will be used anyway. For now, your task is to make an implementation of this under particular circumstances. I will give you some test vectors also. The input of the function that you have to create is 3 different strings and a number n, which indicates how many output bits I want. Right? I will discuss the A51 algorithm next week. So don't panic now, but you could, in the meantime, already try, for example, what happens if I, how can I implement a LFSR? Not 3, just 1. Yeah, how can I make, given a particular feedback, how can I make this into a MATLAB function? That could be a nice start. Use strings. And we discussed that last time. There is a difference between MATLAB. There is a difference between a string with double quote, which is just one element, and a string with single quotes, which is an array of characters. I use single quotes here. So this is what I call a string, but which is in fact a array of characters. Yeah. Don't worry too much about the details now. you will learn a lot about, or you will learn more about the A51 algorithm in the next week. Yeah. So if you go over the slides, you will see already about that. Questions? Yeah.
Is it better to use MATLAB functions, or maybe you can use develop it only with I don't know, like in C++?
No, MATLAB. So programming, you can do whatever you want, but you have to deliver me, as for grading, a MATLAB function. There. This is the MATLAB function that you have to deliver me, a file A51, and that should start with function, key bits, or whatever you want to call it, is A51, and then you have three strings that come in and the number that come in. And this is the function that I will be testing. Yeah. So don't make any C++ implementation except for your own use. I will tell more about the assignment next week also. Yeah, but you can, if everything goes well, you can already see it in Blackboard with all the extra information. Okay, let's have a longer break. Let's start again at 1:15 in E211, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, E211.